Welcome in to the Late Night Gamecock Show. My name is Matt Anderson, and joining me, as always, is Rob Williams of FourQuarterFriday.com. Rob, we might as well go and get into it. We got a lot to get to tonight. SEC Media Days have come. They have went. There's always a lot of topics that come out of it. We're going to get to all of that here in a little bit, but did want to start out with some Gamecock baseball news. Obviously, we'll start with bad news first. And Ethan Sutton, who the Gamecocks thought they had a pretty good chance to hold on to, ultimately signed with the Los Angeles Dodgers. So that's a blow to the pitching staff. But you have the bad news, and you always have the good news, too. The good news is that shortstop Ethan Bass, who was previously committed to Wake Forest, and a player that Wake Forest was probably sweating out during the Major League Baseball draft, but a player that was never going to play at Wake Forest, as we've come to learn, and had overtures from, I believe it was Arkansas, LSU, South Carolina, got him on campus. They got it done. That now means, Rob, that we have two high school players that could have been top three-round draft picks that are coming to South Carolina and playing 2-3 years. I don't know exactly how long they'll have with the age 20 rule and all that, but just your take on getting two of those kind of guys in the program, Rob.
Well, I think it's bigger than just getting two guys like that. I think it's the positions that those two guys play at shortstop and at catcher. You know, the catcher position at South Carolina is a long storied tradition of guys who have been just superb at that position. You now have a coaching staff that is absolutely chock full of former catchers and catching coaches, you know, starting with the head coach and all the way down. And JB announced earlier that Stuart Lake is going to be back on the staff. So that puts another one in there that can throw his experience in with a catcher. And then obviously shortstop has been a position of need, Matt, as you look at the Gamecocks the past couple of years. And that is one where in the SEC week in and week out, night in and night out, you're going to need somebody who is elite at that position, and the Gamecocks need to go and get that done. So not just looking at the future, but some guys that are going to challenge early on to get into that starting group. So I think that it's important because you are upping the overall talent of the roster. I think that it sends a message again about where South Carolina is. And we're going to talk about that nationally in just a moment as well, kind of where some of the national media outside of this bubble that we sit in are starting to talk about the Gamecocks. So There's multiple ripple effects, but I think the biggest thing for me is just those specific position groups is even bigger than saying, hey, you got two guys that could have been top three-round picks.
And, Rob, I'll add to that. It seems like South Carolina is getting back to having baseball players. And, like, J.D. Stein came in from Wake Forest as well. Obviously, Ethan Bass was committed to Wake Forest. Like, they knew what the situation was at Wake. We'll see what the situation is at South Carolina, but just having all these players that seem to have slashes by their name, whether they're pitchers or infielders or outfielders, and all of them seem to be able to hit the baseball, which South Carolina has missed. We'll figure out what the Gamecocks do with the rest of the roster. The way I understand it, they have at least two roster spots available, probably both going to go to pitchers now with Ethan Sutton making the move over. But, Rob, before we get on to SEC Media Days, did you see that on, I believe it was D1 Baseball, that one of their experts predicted South Carolina to make the College World Series next year?
Yeah, I did. And that was, you know, a little bit of what I was referencing before. When you look at the national scene, looking back to South Carolina, obviously Jack DeLongchamps has connections to the University of South Carolina. And so he's familiar with the history and what baseball looks like in this state. But I do think it says something for those with a national platform to go, hey, we need to probably pay attention to what's happening in Columbia, because whether they're back in Omaha or not, Matt, I think this team is poised to make a little more noise than what the average fan is going to expect them to. I think the average SEC fan is probably going to expect South Carolina to be in a rebuild. You got a new coach. You're kind of bringing it back together. But it's 2026, Matt, and things move a lot quicker than they did in years past. So this is not a 3 to 5 year total turnaround. I think in 3 years we will be back to having expectations of Omaha year in and year out if the build goes as Kevin Schnall has laid it out. So big jump to go from where the team was last year back to Omaha in back-to-back years. But I wouldn't put it past them. I'm not here to say I think that's going to happen. But again, it's 2026 and the portal does a lot for your team. And when you look around the country, these portal players had to come from somewhere. So everybody is gaining and losing, and roster turnover is a big thing. So we'll see. We're going to have to get to the actual season to try to figure that out, where everybody stands, because right now you don't know what you got till you put them together on the field.
Yeah, I don't think it's crazy. I mean, if you look at it, every expert predicted between 4 and 7 SEC teams to make it to Omaha. And when I'm talking about the D1 baseball expert panel, there were 11 on there. Only one of them picked South Carolina, so we'll put it in perspective. But at the same time, this team has fixed a lot of the issues that they dealt with last year. And I'll always say it's a lot easier to pitch if you have a 3 or 4 run lead as opposed to being down a run or two, or, you know, maybe only up a run. So we'll see what happens with Gamecock baseball. SEC media days were a lot of fun, Rob. I tried to pull just kind of what I thought were the meaningful things for the Gamecocks. Obviously, SEC Sunday night's probably going to have a lot of commentary about what this coach said or that coach said. But we've talked about this, Rob. Both Tennessee and Alabama, Josh Heupel and DeBoer both said that they still have a quarterback battle going on. And you talked about this last week with Tennessee specifically. Do you think this is coach speak, or do you think this is the real deal and they don't know?
No, I think it's the real deal. I would even say that in Alabama as well, but specifically in Tennessee, I think that you have the issue of the strong, accurate arm with McIntyre, who has been in the system for now for 2 years because he's a redshirt freshman, versus the true freshman, who is an absolute electric player in Faison Brandon, who's yeah, going to be their quarterback in the long term. But we all know that the Heupel offense, which is not all too different from the Briles offense, is predicated on accuracy. And as long as the quarterback can be accurate and hit the receiver, then the offense is going to move. If he's not accurate, then you're going to stall out. You're going to go 3 and out. You're going to put your defense in bad situations. So you have to be able to put the ball in the right place. And if George McIntyre starts the year as the guy who can do that, if you're on the right hash and your guy's running your tight end's running an out to the left side, and you've got to throw it and put enough zip on it and put it on his hands so that somebody doesn't jump that route for a pick six, you got to know that you have a guy out there that can do that. So, yeah. I think that the big thing with Tennessee, when they played at South Carolina in 2022 and the Gamecocks lit them up, Hendon Hooker had an uncharacteristically off night. He was not accurate with the football, and that played a lot into how that night went down. So I think that's what Heupel's looking at. The thing in Tuscaloosa is familiarity with Austin Mack. He's a passing guy. And again, I think Keelan Russell is just – I think he's the guy. But I don't know if they know what to do with him. JC has said that time and time again. Can Grubb and DeBoer figure out what the heck to do with a guy who's a dual threat?
That's the million-dollar question for Alabama. And going back to Tennessee, you know, Rob, I sit here and think about it like I've said for a while, that eventually – the SEC is either going to figure out Josh Heupel's offense, or he's not going to have the quarterback that can run it. And you've seen that. And everything you just talked about, you know, ripping that ball from the right to the left and getting the ball there, either the freshman quarterback is going to be able to show it in fall camp, like, I got this. But if that fails for Tennessee, the whole offense has to start asking questions about how are we going to manufacture yards, because they just play so far out on the hashes. So we'll see. Those are two things that I'm going to be tracking. I'll put it this way. Like, I listen to SEC Media Day and I'm like, what are the important things? What are the things that impact the Gamecocks? And both of those things were important for me. Moving on, you have League Commissioner Greg Sankey talking about maybe the SEC leaves. And sometimes I think Sankey can be a little bit like the current U.S. president, and just saying, hey, like, maybe I'll do it, maybe I won't, but, you know, think about it. I could do it. And I had an article on thebigspur.com talking about the Big Ten and the SEC, and the race is tighter than ever as to who's the most elite conference. But Sankey has not done, I would say his job for the SEC, and Eli Drinkwitz in Missouri kind of said it. He kind of said the quiet part out loud. We were told that if we went to 9 SEC games, then we were going to have an expanded playoff. It didn't happen. So, you know, just those two quotes, those two conversations, Rob, I want to get your take on it.
I think that Greg Sankey got, how do I say this in a politically correct way? I think he lost. I think he was hoodwinked. I think he was tricked. I don't know. Like in going to this 9-game schedule, it was a terrible decision. He folded. Okay. He folded. It is not good for the league. I'm not really sure what the rationale was. I stood on the table and said, no, 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 don't do that, because you're gonna lose presence in the national tournament, playoff, whatever you want to call it, the biggest stage in all of college football. And years ago, you know, when it was just a 4-team playoff, ESPN and the family of around that network pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed the college football playoff. And it really aided the programs that got in early on. So like your Ohio States, your Alabama's, Clemson, who got in there, got so much airtime, Matt. They got so much run on national television, and everything about the regular season and leading up to the postseason and then the postseason itself, there was no mention of other regular season games. There was no mention of the bowl games. It was just these four teams, which allowed them to step into dynasty mode, because that exposure really aided them in recruiting and put them on the forefront where they just continued to reload. You needed to fall. And I said back then, like, if you want to see one of these teams fall out, they're going to have to miss the playoff 2 years in a row. 1 year is not going to do it because they're still relevant in people's minds. Now you're in danger of putting the SEC teams with the playoff not expanding out of that conversation. Yes, it expanded to 12, and so more teams are included. And more teams are getting those airwaves when in terms of promotion on college game day, on the Thursday night game. There's every chance that every opportunity that they get, if it's on the ESPN family of networks, whether the game's being played on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, or Sunday, they're going to talk about the college football playoff. So those teams are going to come up in that discussion as we get closer. A 9-game schedule knocks more SEC teams out. And Matt, if it doesn't expand beyond 12 in the next couple of years, does the SEC take a permanent step back from the Big Ten because they've fallen out of quote-unquote relevance for more than 1 or 2 years in this 12-team format with a 9-game league schedule? I think Greg Sankey set them up for a bad forward trajectory in the national scene unless the playoff expands soon.
Yeah, I mean, Sankey got absolutely played on multiple fronts. The fact that the Big Ten brought in Southern Cal, they brought in Oregon. Yeah. Like, I mean, these are national brands that have appeal and have only elevated the Big Ten. And on top of that, the SEC still mandates that you play at least one game against another power conference every single year. And they did it to maintain the rivalries. I understand it, but something's going to have to give for the SEC, because you never hear about a Big Ten team being left out of the 12-team playoff and everybody upset. You never hear about an ACC team left out of the top 12 in the college football playoff. It's always SEC teams that have that gripe. And like, you can go read the article I put on thebigspur.com and you know, read more about it. And I'd love to get your take on it. It's so interesting, because it's like when that pendulum swings, like, how are you going to figure out how to compete again? And like right now, the SEC still has a better conference top to bottom. They still have more NFL draft picks, but they've lost 3 of the last 5 national championships, and the 2 they won of those 5 were both Georgia. So the SEC needs to find a way to make that happen again. I do want to move on to Shane Beamer's comments at SEC Media Day. You know, the typical stuff, using last season as motivation. I do agree with Shane, and I want to get your take on this, Rob, but for the life of me, like, I don't understand why the national media and the SEC media seem to have the memory of a goldfish. Last year, Lenore Sellers was a, no doubt about it, top 5 overall pick in the NFL draft. It was first team preseason all SEC. And then you don't look at the actual narrative of what happened during the season. And all of a sudden, 18 guys have jumped him. And at 18, like, there's not 18 quarterbacks in the SEC. I understand that. But it's just like all of a sudden you can just be forgotten. And, you know, like I think Shane's right. Like, if you don't believe in us, then we don't believe in you. We're going to prove you wrong, because just last year we were the darling.
Is this narrative, this underdog mentality, it seems to be the number one prevailing theme that we saw throughout Shane Beamer, Lenore Sellers, Nick Harbor speaking over the course of the day there, Matt. Do we think that that's good for them? Because I kind of do. I kind of like the position that they're in. It gives a little extra motivation. And I do think everything trickles down from the top. And we know that Shane Beamer is a receipts guy. So if you say something that pisses him off or that rubs him the wrong way, it's probably not going to come out. And you're not going to see it on his face. It's not going to be a forward-facing thing. He's not going to get into this battle of words necessarily back and forth with you. But he does stow it away and uses it for motivation. And once he has proved you wrong, a lot of times that's when the receipts get brought out.
Yeah.
I wonder if that mentality has not bled down to the rest of the team, where now he has a great opportunity. Last year, he didn't really have this opportunity, Matt, because there were those expectations. Now, I think that you're absolutely right. In spite of what was being said just 1 year ago, the Gamecocks are picked near the bottom. By and I know you guys were on the air the other day when you got the SEC media poll, and you kind of see where they fall, and some of the teams that they're behind, Matt. I think that it's a motivating factor for not just for Shane Beamer. I think it has gripped this team in terms of what's driving them in the moments where they may want to let go of the rope a little bit. And these are the dog days. These aren't just the dog days for us, where there's not a ton of sports going on. These are the dog days for them as well, because this is conditioning time. This is workout time. The whole offseason has gone by. You get a couple of weeks there with spring ball, and right around the corner, you get preseason camp where, yes, it's fun and it's real football, but it's also August and September in South Carolina. So it is grind. It is grueling. It is hot. It's long, long days of preparation. And when your mind starts to flutter, I think that the message is probably being said around the program, hey, don't forget, they think we're going to suck.
I think that's – I don't know if I would – I mean, obviously, you'd rather be really good every single year and then, like, say we got to stay here, right? Like, that's the motivating message. I mean, I know that, you know, Nick Saban was more angry after bad wins than he was after losses. Because, like, we expect to do this, that, or the other, and we didn't do it, and, you know, we lost the game. We deserved it, right? So, I mean, when you asked me the question, is it better to be the underdog or better to be the favorite, or is it provide extra motivation? It better provide extra motivation until you reach, you know, whatever that goal is for the season. And then the next season, that goal is the expectation. And then we want to go higher than that. So, I don't know if it's good or bad for South Carolina. I had an article on thebigspur.com that talked about preseason expectations and being ranked or getting votes in the AP preseason media poll, top 25, whatever. And the data seems to show that if the Gamecocks aren't ranked, they're probably going to have a better season than if they were ranked and staying there. So that's why I say the Gamecocks have to get there and stay there. And they did it for 3 years under Steve Spurrier, but they haven't done it since. Another thing Shane said is, like, I don't feel like he gave a real update to Dylan Stewart or Jacarius Peak. I mean, he said, you know, Peak's out there doing stuff. Dylan Stewart's out there doing stuff. We're going to lean on the doctors. I will say, just from my relationships and contacts inside the program, people I speak to, I think that Jacarius Peak's going to be fine. I think he avoided, you know, that terrible, like, multi-ligament injury playing basketball, you know, last spring, early summer, whenever that occurred. I think that Dylan Stewart's going to be fine as well, but there's just an extra precaution you have to take with a future top 10 NFL draft pick. And it's a different era than, you know, I go back to Grant Hill just getting shot up in the foot before every single game to go play. Like, they're not doing that anymore. I mean, you get back to Zion and Kyrie Irving at Duke. Like, I'm using Grant Hill, Zion, Kyrie, Duke analogies here. Like, you kind of seen that transition of, like, what you do when you have a star player.
Yeah, they sat.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they're probably going to be fine. I think you'll see them both week three at the latest. They did ask the question about place kicker, Rob. I don't know if you had an opportunity to listen to it. I think that it was kind of a non-answer. And Shane's main response was, I don't think you have to have, you know, a starter named until a week or two before the start of the season, which I'm all about competition. That's fine. But they got to figure it out.
This is the one that scares me, Matt. When you talk about Peak and Stewart, you know, I think that we've all heard enough to feel optimistic about both of those. And, you know, not to put the cart before the horse, but to feel like things are moving along well. The kicker thing, on the other hand, it concerns me. It concerns me a little bit because I'm not sure that when you have a couple of known kickers on the roster, and I get it that players get better from year to year, and then you have some transfers that came in. Taking another guy late in the cycle kind of signaled to me, we don't really know what's going on. We don't really know if we got what we need.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just me. But I did talk to one contact who I think has a decent grip on it and definitely knows what SEC kicking is all about. And I think there are still some question marks. I'll just put it that way.
I'll put it that way too. And look, I've been doing all these deep dives into the SEC opponents and the power conference opponents, Rob. And one thing that I'm seeing is transfer kickers in some cases coming over because you know what? They were daggum near automatic. And if we talk about like spending money on a place kicker, like sometimes, you know, a couple $100,000 is worth it if you have a reliable place kicker. And we'll see what it means. I mean, I know a lot of people that I talk to say like they'll be fine. Like the idea is not to kick field goals, right? Like give him an opportunity, give him a shot, but we want him to kick extra points and he can do that. We'll see. Place kicker is still a worry for me. On Briles, Shane Beamer was finally asked about him, which I thought was, you know, ironic that the entire national media hasn't been talking about an SEC offensive coordinator hire that has proven
it's weird
be successful everywhere he's been. And it's just completely ignored. Look, you know, a lot of things that Shane said is, hey, you know, I remember, you know, facing Briles a couple years ago and like, he always got off to a fast start. That's what we want to do. And, you know, we're going to be aggressive, but the offense is simple. Like I thought it was a lot of coach talk, but I do think that it was important saying like, you know, with Kendall, if it's 4th and 3, 4th and 9, he's going to want to go for it. And I think that aggressiveness needs to be reined in from Shane Beamer, but also it's important to say, we actually have an offensive coordinator that in that situation doesn't have to rifle through the plays to say, maybe this one here, give me 30 seconds and then substitute 8 seconds before, you know, you get a penalty. Maybe that is what Shane was trying to say there. And that's just me putting words in Shane's mouth that he did not say.
Yeah, I think that I think I want to see consistency over the course of the game. And that would have been the question that I asked, like, how do you make the adjustments in the flow of game action to continue sustained success? Because even as putrid as the Gamecocks offense was for most of last year, a lot of the success they did find was on the scripted plays at the beginning. So like making a note that, hey, Kendall Briles is going to come out hot. Well, if they did anything right last year, the Gamecocks came out and were able to score early. You look at Virginia Tech, you look at obviously Texas A&M. Mm-hmm. So I want
to see two different offensive coordinators there, which is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. But the consistency that I want to see is in the third quarter, in the second quarter, when you have a few drives in and you're past the script and now the defense is adjusting, how do you adjust back? That is the chess match that really exists in the NFL, but still exists at the college level where it is more simplified. And if you see a hole or a weakness, you go and you expose it over and over and over again until the defense adjusts and makes up for it. I know Kendall Briles can do that, but I would have liked to get Shane Beamer's thoughts on that had I been able to ask him a question nobody seemed to want to ask, Matt.
Yeah, there's some questions that, you know, like you, you kind of think like you might just get coach speak from it, but like Shane's pretty daggum honest. Like he's probably just going to say what he's thinking. And that's one of the great things about Shane Beamer is like when he says something, he means it. And like, he doesn't like injuries, whatever, every coach does the injury game, but like Shane is usually very, very honest. And when he's frustrated, you can tell he's frustrated. When he's feeling good, you can tell he's feeling good. So yeah, I mean, those are kind of questions that you wish could have been answered or asked or whatnot. But I do want to highlight Lenore Sellers here. Lenore Sellers has said something in SEC Media Days that I really relate to. And it's one of the things that I think has been difficult for him having multiple offensive coordinators during his time at South Carolina and not being able to realize his true athletic and passing potential. But he said he needs to work on trusting what he's seen, getting the ball out quickly, his footwork. And the reason I think that's important, Rob, if you go back 2-3 years ago, that was one of the things that Dowell Loggins expressed to the media. I need Lenore to just see it, trust it, trust his arm, and just get it there. And I think when you're a quarterback that's having to break 15 tackles against Clemson 2 years ago and last year, I mean, under duress immediately, it's hard to even make a decision. So I'm hoping that this offensive line, this scheme is going to allow Lenore to see it, rip it, see it, rip it, see it, rip it. If it's not there, let me use my legs. Because make no doubt about it, Rob, he was told not to run a lot last year by Mike Shula.
Yeah.
So when you have those two conflicting things, like there is no fight or flight. It's like, I'm just going to fall down or throw the ball out of bounds. Like I want to be an NFL quarterback. This is what NFL quarterbacks do. You can't do that in college.
Yeah, and I think that you mentioned NFL quarterbacks. The new series, shameless non-connected plug here, the season of Quarterback on Netflix came out today or the last couple of days or something. And so I was watching this morning, and in the first game that Cam Ward played for the Titans last year, he gets bottled up in the pocket, and they're against Denver, and he steps up, and the defender sucks in. He dumps it out to the running back for a big 15-yard play for a first down. When I look at Lenore Sellers, the added element that I expect to see with Kendall Briles here is that hot route outlet, where if he gets in trouble, he not only has the option to put his head down and go, but he's going to have the check down that is, whether it's a tight end or it's a back or something that's available to him in space, that's going to be able to do something with the ball after catching it. And if Lenore Sellers, he already knows how to run like a read option where he's reading a guy. If he's able to say, hey, I have nothing downfield, let me step up and then spit this ball out to this guy who's waiting here, I think that adds an element that's very, very simple. And we know that Kendall Briles is going to be able to make things happen in space and maximize the talent on the team. So that would be the element that I think helps out with the sacks as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right on the money here, Rob. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll have Justin Lyles of sportscatvalue.com. But can't wait to see you all back here in just a couple minutes. Welcome back into the Late Night Gamecock Show. Again, my name is Matt Anderson, and Rob Williams is here with me. We're also going to welcome Justin Lyles of sportscatvalue.com. Justin has been helping us work our way through the Gamecocks SEC schedule, and obviously we'll get to that Clemson game next week. But we got four games left. We're going to get to the Texas A&M game and the Arkansas game shortly. But Justin, man, what do we do now that we're in the dog days of summer? It's just Major League Baseball.
I think you froze up there for a second. Say that again.
Justin, like, man, we're in the dog days of summer now. Like, it's just Major League Baseball and the WNBA. I don't know how you're handling it. I mean, I guess there's some golf there, but all the majors are behind us.
So. Yeah, it's the dog days. It's, we took 2 days off this week, and that's not intentionally. It's just you don't see anything you like, you know, on the MLB slate. So, and you got golf plays up, you know, the tournaments are weaker, you know, post the Open Championship. We're just counting down the days till September.
I totally understand that. I do want to get your take really quick on, are the Braves going to hold on in the NL East? They've started the post All-Star break hot. The teams that need to lose, the days they lose, have been losing. But I think it's, what, a 4.5-game, 4-game lead at this point?
Yeah, I think it's about a handful of games. They've been kind of back and forth for the last 30 days, last month. But The Phillies are kind of pressing and pushing, and I expect the Phillies to make a move come the deadline of August 3rd. They've been pretty aggressive with their GM over the years. He has a history of being aggressive. We'll see if the Braves do anything, but I expect Atlanta to kind of win the NL to close it out.
Well, I know I love to hear it. I think Rob likes to hear it. Rob, are you a Braves fan? I've never asked you.
You know, to be honest, when it comes to the MLB, yes, I would consider myself a Braves fan. I wouldn't say that I'm a diehard anything in that space, but if I'm something, it's a Braves fan. I was born in the 90s. There was Braves stuff all over the house.
There you go. Well, we'll see if the Braves hold on. I mean, you heard Justin Lyles just say it. He thinks they will. This guy knows baseball. He knows all sports. And we're going to keep working our way through the schedule. Right now, Justin has the Gamecocks at 6-2. And it seems like the more challenging part of the schedule is going to begin tonight. And we'll start with Texas A&M. I'm going to go ahead and say it. We all know what happened last year. We've seen the ESPN graphic. Teams are 0-400,000 when they have this type of lead. But we'll get into it here, Justin. This game is going to be at home this year. So it's going to be in Williams-Brice Stadium, November 7th. According to Phil Steele, they have the 13th most experienced roster in the country, the 28th toughest schedule in the country. If you look at his power poll, where he just views teams as plus minus, who's the best team? 12th best team in the country. 12th best team in the country, but projected to finish 5th in the SEC, according to Phil Steele. So, Rob, talk us through this roster and what you're looking at, what you're thinking about, and I'll fill in any gaps.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at Texas A&M, you obviously want to start with Marcel Reed. And to be honest with you, Matt, even after – I feel like we have a bigger sample size with him now, and I'm still not sold. You know what I mean? I'm still not sold on his consistency. Can he be a passer who doesn't turn the ball over? He's just a little streaky for me. And to be honest, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about what happened in College Station last year when the Gamecocks were there. But that game is a microcosm of his entire career. There are times when he has boneheaded moments where we're not sure what he's doing, and then he becomes really brilliant. He is a former midseason Heisman winner, where everybody thought he was going to do it last year. I think it was John Mateer and then the injury. But a couple of years ago, it was definitely Marcel Reed. So, you know, I don't want to put too much on him. Reuben Owens is a great back, and I think they have the weapons out wide. Mario Craver, obviously, we've seen what he can do. I like Isaiah Horton kind of coming into that group from Alabama. And so I think that he's going to have some weapons around him. The offensive line is still good. I wouldn't say great. I think they're pretty good. Obviously, Phil still has them as 16th best. But I have a couple of question marks along that front. Now, on the defensive side, I feel pretty good because it's Mike Elko. If I'm an Aggie, I'm feeling pretty good year in and year out, just the same way, Matt, that Gamecock fans would say, like, a Torian Gray is always going to have the secondary ready to go, or you know that you're going to get something with Shane Beamer, special teams. I think when it comes to Mike Elko in defense, you're pretty good to go. Obviously, they lost a couple of coordinators. I don't think that matters as much on the defensive side. I do have questions about play calling because they made an internal promotion to a guy who's never done it before. So that is a question mark for me in putting some of these weapons into place.
Yeah, and like we'll stick on defense right now. I don't think that the play caller is going to be a first-time play caller just with freelance over the defense. I think Mike Elko is going to kind of have his say there. I will say that I think their secondary is one of the best in the country. They have multiple guys that can just play good coverage. Like, honestly, like they can man up guys. They can just like run free and they'll be fine.
That starts with Des Ricks, obviously. Like, yeah, I think he's locked down.
Yeah. I am excited to, I say excited guys, like this is a Gamecock show, I know, but they have some pretty good linebackers as well. I mean, TJ Searcy is kind of like the headliner on defense.
Yeah.
He stops the run, and that allows their defense to be more aggressive and be more free. And their defensive tackles, both of them, they had a lot of pressures last year. So they were able to get pressure up the middle. Moving over to offensive line, I'm not even going to lie to you, man. I do think they have some question marks. Left side specifically. And you look at Tyree Adams, 6'7", 310, comes over after three seasons at LSU, but he played 517 snaps last year, and he graded as a below-average left tackle. And I know Marcel Reed can run, can make things happen, but Blake Ivey, if he's going to be their left guard, 6'3", 336, he only has 97 career snaps.
Yeah.
And their center and their right tackle, center Mark Nabu and right tackle Wilkin Formby are very good players, but we saw Trevon Ball, I can't even say it after 3 years in South Carolina. We saw Trevon struggle for the Gamecocks in multiple situations, especially last year. I do think you're right when you talk about Mario Carver or Craver and Isaiah Horton. I think those two guys are really good wide receivers. At running back, I think they're just okay. Marcel Reed's only been sacked on 5% of his dropbacks, so he kind of is a Houdini back there. But I just don't know, man. Like, I always say that eventually Texas A&M will Texas A&M, right?
They will.
They probably
he throws a pick. He doesn't get sacked, but sometimes he throws a pick. I mean, you look at the numbers, it's not like his interceptions are low by any stretch.
No, I mean, 19 interceptions in his career. I mean, I like their place kicker. Like, their field goal kicker's good. He's going to be pretty money inside, you know, 60 yards. He's going to be fine. The punter, 96 career punts, 4-point something hang time on his punch that gives them an opportunity to get downfield and you know, make a stop. But I was actually intrigued by this. When you look at Phil Steele's All-Americans, there are zero for Texas A&M.
Yeah.
So zero All-Americans, which kind of makes sense of why they might be fifth in his SEC projections. And then even on the preseason Phil Steele All-SEC players, there are only five of them. One of them is a long snapper. So I think Texas A&M, I think that they have a pretty nice schedule. We're going to get to it right now. So, Justin, bring you in for this. I know you've crunched the data. Missouri State will go and give them a win, but they play Arizona State. Aggies won only meeting this series in 2015, and they're going to head to Tempe next year, we assume, if these games are going to be continue to be played. But do you think Arizona State's going to be a challenge for them?
No, I don't think so. Not this early in the season. I would say no.
So we'll give them two wins. We'll start 2-0. Then they host Kentucky, which is crazy that A&M's been in the SEC for a long time, but this is only the second time they'll play Kentucky. A&M has won their last three SEC home openers, but this Kentucky team, nobody knows what to expect. Is this an opportunity for Kentucky to sneak up and get in the national picture, Justin, early in the season?
No, I think it's just too soon with the new staff at Kentucky still trying to get their feet wet. I think A&M kind of cruises to a 3-0 start.
Well, then they head to LSU, and this is back-to-back years they're going to the Bayou. LSU had actually won 11 in a row in this series, but A&M's won three out of the last four. We know that Lane Kiffin will be there this year. We know there's a lot of excitement in Baton Rouge. I cannot imagine what this environment is going to be like. It's probably the first real test for Texas A&M. So I want to get your take, Justin. What happens when they travel to the Bayou?
It's going to be a tough one. I mean, defense is going to keep them in it. The question is, it goes back to Reed. Can he make enough plays to get them over the hump here? And I just don't see it happening. I'm going to take LSU.
All right. Well, then Arkansas travels to College Station. The Aggies have won four straight in this series and 13 of the last 14 meetings. However, this is interesting when I found this out. The Aggies have only covered the spread once over the last eight games. Is Arkansas giving them a scare here?
No, unfortunately. No. Going to be a tough year for Arkansas, I think. At least that's what the projection, that's what the experts are saying. I tend to agree with them. I'm going to take A&M here.
All right, so we got a 4-1 right now. Then they travel to Missouri. The Aggies have won three straight in the series and have not trailed at any point in either of these or any of these three games. This seems like the very first inflection point for Texas A&M outside of LSU. Are you going to go on the road in the SEC against a quality coach, a quality team, and assert dominance this season again?
I'm gonna take A&M here to get the upset. I guess on the road, a tough spot. I think their defense travels.
Rob, any thoughts there?
I think it's a good point that the defense travels. So I can kind of see where you're coming from. You know, as I'm looking at it here too, I don't disagree with you, Justin.
I like that.
I'm on the fence. I'm on the fence, but I'm going to land there.
Well, their next game against the Citadel, we'll go and give them their sixth win of the season. Then they travel to Tuscaloosa. This is interesting to me. The Aggies have lost 10 out of the last 11 meetings against Alabama, and they have not won on the road since 2012 when Johnny Manziel was the quarterback for Texas A&M. So, Rob, let's go ahead and talk about this matchup, and we'll make sure we get Justin back here in a second. It sounded like some kids were trying to fight bath time or something.
Yeah, no, I mean, that Houdini move that Manziel made now 14 years ago, Matt, is what is the lone moment in Aggie lore against Alabama in this generation, right?
Yeah.
This is tough. And we have questions about Alabama. We talked about them earlier in the show. Obviously, we talked about them earlier in the season of this show with Justin as we went through Alabama's roster and their schedule and whatnot. This looks like a toss-up to me. You asked the question a minute ago for me. Did I agree with him about Missouri? I've been really high on Missouri. I've been really high on Austin Simmons. And I always have questions about Texas A&M, but I did pick Texas A&M to beat Missouri in that game. It's been that way for weeks on my spreadsheet. I'm not going to lie to you and go back and change it because I've been carrying my Mizzou flag. So, but this Alabama game, I have the Tide winning that game. I think I'm a little higher on Alabama than some others, Matt. I don't think they're going to be as good as they have been, but I think they're still right on the edge of the playoff. And I just don't know, man. I just don't know about Texas A&M because at some point, they're like you said, they're going to do that thing where they don't get over the hump.
Yeah, I think so too. Justin, it sounded like a kid might have got out of the bathtub there. Something happened, but I'll fill you in on what you missed. Rob does have the Aggies dropping this game on the road to Alabama. I think I agree with him, and I think this also opens up the toughest part of the schedule for A&M where we're going to find out who the real Aggies are. So what are your thoughts on this road trip to Alabama?
Yeah, I think Alabama's going to be better than what a lot of people are giving them credit for. I think A&M drops it to Alabama as well.
All right, so we got the Aggies at 6-2. And like I mentioned, they're going to have the tough part of their schedule coming up. But first, they're going to have a bye week. After the bye week, they travel back to Columbia, to Williams-Brice Stadium. A&M leads this all-time series 10-2. Everybody remembers the game we talked about last year, but Gamecock fans still remember the 24 unanswered points they put on A&M 2 years ago. I will say that I ran the numbers the other day just for fun, and this was when I was on the show on Friday with Phil and JC. Mike Elko has only given up 22 points per game to SEC opponents over the last two seasons. South Carolina has averaged like 37 points per game or 33 points a game against Mike Elko, and obviously there's some defensive scores, special team scores that are mixed in there. But with A&M being 10-2 all time, this game in Williams-Brice Stadium, I think you've mentioned it before, Justin. There are a couple like points on the Gamecock season where have they arrived? Can they carry this momentum? They're 6-2 at this point, according to what we've talked about. Give me your thoughts on this game.
Yeah, this is the game that regardless of what the schedule is, you know, as far as South Carolina coming in, whether they're 6-2, 3-5. However it's going, this is going to be circled. They let one slip away last year, and I think no matter what, they're going to have A&M numbered here. So give me the Gamecocks, obviously.
Yeah, Rob, we'll talk more about it when we have our prediction show, and that's when Justin gets to flip the tables on us and give us his take on what we're saying. We do have the benefit of knowing what his thoughts, but we'll always take those, by the way. We'll always take his thoughts over ours. So we got the Aggies at 6-3 right now, and this is a tough three-game stretch. It starts on at home against Tennessee. The Vols lead this all-time series 3-2. I cannot believe they've only played five times.
Yeah, this is a very a matchup that I think late in the season is going to be one of the better matchups that we're not really talking about yet. I think Tennessee is going to be probably a little underrated coming into the season. I think they'll show their true colors, and this will be probably one of the, you know, playoff implications type ordeals. But I think A&M squeaks by here at home.
All right, so we'll give them their seventh win of the season. Doesn't get any easier over the next two. They travel to Oklahoma. And this is crazy to me, but it's the first meeting since the 2012 Cotton Bowl. Do you think that they can go on the road to Oklahoma, have all kinds of tricks in play for Brett Venables, this Oklahoma defense? Or what are your thoughts here, Justin?
What do we have the record at
so far? Right now, we got the record at 7-3.
Okay. I think I can't remember what I said, but I think they lose this game here. I think they're going to lose this game. So I think they've got to beat Oklahoma or LSU. One of those they've got to pull out. But
yeah. Okay. Well, actually, you know, Justin, the over-under is 8.5. The over is plus 100. The under is 122. Right now we have them at 7-4, and they play Texas. This is a revenge game for A&M. Texas ruined their perfect season last year. And the Aggies have lost three in a row to Texas.
Yeah, I think A&M responds here and gets the win at home. I think they're due.
All right. Well, that puts them at 8-4, and that means Vegas is right on the number right now with the over-under 8.5. Would you take the under minus 122 or just lay off this one, Justin?
This is a stay away from me. Yeah. I think it's just too – They were in a lot of close games last year. I expect some regression from them. So I think 9-3 or 8-4 is probably what they're going to end up at.
Yeah, and you just got to stay away from it. Well, we're going to move on to Arkansas. We'll do this one a little bit faster because this is a team that's actually predicted to finish last in the SEC. But this game will be on the road at Arkansas November 14th. We'll see what Arkansas's mindset is at this point in the season. Phil Steele has their experience chart as 119th in the country. The fourth toughest schedule in the country, a power pull rank of 55th, and like I said, projected to finish 16th in the SEC. So, Rob Williams, take it away. Tell us about this roster and the guys we need to be paying attention to.
Oof. Well, you wanted to do this one faster, and we can certainly do it, okay? they've got KJ Jackson at quarterback. He's attempted 54 passes, okay? So we don't really know what's going to happen there. Phil still has the running back group listed as 60th in the country. Not a lot of experience in that group either. You got Sutton Smith coming over from Memphis, obviously. Ryan Silverfield also is head coach coming over from Memphis. So there's some continuous relationship there. Braylon Russell is a player that Gamecock fans are probably still familiar with, especially if you follow recruiting. And he's behind Sutton Smith right now. So maybe not increased growth there. At the wide receiver position, they have a lot of transfers. This whole roster is just littered with transfers because of the coaching change. So it is a big question at the skill positions, in the trenches, on offense, on defense, of how they can mesh together. You have a strange mix here. Of guys who were brought up from another level, G5 level, especially because Silverfield's experience at Memphis. And then there is another tactic that was used of kind of picking and grabbing guys that were on that two deep or maybe third string at a power four, another SEC school, something like that. The only one that really sticks out to me is their kicker, Max Gilbert, who started at Tennessee last year. So somebody who really has some solid SEC experience is the kicker. And the question is, will he be able to go out there and participate in the football game very often? I'm not sure.
Well, I will say this. I do think their linebackers have some interesting characters there. Their Jack linebacker, Steven Soles, spent two seasons at Kentucky, but he is an elite, elite pass rusher. Not good in coverage. Don't get me wrong. Not a guy that, you know, can handle conflict well, but he has 34 career quarterback pressures and has only played 233 snaps. So that's a 14.5% pressure rate. And then the other guy that I really am interested to see what happens is Will linebacker Jaquavion Smith, 6'1", 225 from Howard, played 424 snaps at Howard last season. But when you look at his numbers, y'all, it's truly elite. Like, if he had stayed at Howard, he might be a second or third round NFL draft pick. He's going to level up to the SEC right now. And that is one person that I have circled, because I do think you can find players from lower levels that are just ridiculously elite and bring them on and fill in gaps if you're a football coach in the SEC. Secondary is fine. I think the defense is going to be better than it was last year for Arkansas. But that, like you said, Rob, there's just a lot of question marks here. Max Gilbert, he's a great kicker. The punter is Gavin Rush. He's never attempted a collegiate punt. We'll see how it goes for him. They're another team that has no All-Americans, according to Phil Steele, in the preseason. Only two players, Quincy Rhodes, defensive end, and then offensive guard Malachi Breland, who is going to be potential All-SEC players, like, according to Phil Steele. So there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of moving parts. I can understand why they're ranked 16th. I could see them being one of those teams that comes up and snipes somebody at some point during the season. I do want to make note that their quarterback is a lefty, which you don't see very often, but he has a little bit of dual threat to him as well. Going to the schedule here, Justin, they open against North Alabama. Is there any opportunity here to take North Alabama against the spread and just think that they'll be able to hang in there?
I'm looking at the line. It's 40.5, so, I mean, it's a lot of points. But Arkansas cruises to this one.
Yeah, then they go on the road and they go play Utah. And this is the first game ever for the Arkansas football program in the state of Utah. I don't see very much to be optimistic there for Arkansas. Either of you guys want to change my mind here?
What the heck are they doing? What the heck are they doing? Somebody get a hold of Hunter Yurecek and tell him to fix this issue as if he's capable.
You got him hanging in there against Utah, Justin?
I don't know. I think it's going to be a long year for Razorback country. No.
All right. So then they go. Then they host Georgia. We'll go and give them a loss there, I think. And then they have Tulsa. But this is where we're at with, like, a team in transition with so many G5 transfers and players from Howard. Rob Williams, I see your finger. Let's go. Tell us what you got here.
Watch out now. Watch out for Tulsa. Against this Arkansas team, you think this is one that you can count, but if Arkansas doesn't gel and you have an offense full of players that would have been playing in a conference with Tulsa last year anyway, this could get sneaky.
Yeah. I'm taking Arkansas, but I'm very nervous here. This is really going to – if they lose this game,
it's North Texas all over again.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this will be one that I'll be very excited, and I promise I'll make a note right now to add this to our college pick'em when we do that during the regular season, which Justin always just knocks out of the park. Then they go on the road, Texas A&M. We already have that as a loss. We've talked about that today. They host Tennessee. I'm pretty sure we picked Tennessee already here, Justin, so that might be a one in five start. Yeah. And then Vanderbilt on the road. This is one I can see Arkansas just finding a way to get it done. I think Vanderbilt's going to take a step back, but I have no idea. This is the first meeting since 2018, first visit to Nashville since 2011. First off, no SEC team should ever wait 8 years to play each other again, and certainly not 15 years to go to another team's stadium.
Yeah, that's well said. I think I'm with you. I think Arkansas gets the win here. You spoke earlier about the middle of their season, picking up a game or two, and this is the spot that they do.
Well, they're 2-5 heading into the bye week. They'll host Missouri for homecoming. Missouri's won 4 straight, 9 of the last 10 games. Do they build on momentum after their road win against Vanderbilt, Justin?
I don't know. I think Missouri, a lot of people's not talking about Missouri, but they seem to be, you know, pretty steady. I'm going to take Missouri.
All right, we're at 2-6 right now. Then they go on the road against Auburn. The road team has won 6 of the last 7 meetings and are 7-0 against the spread in these games.
I think Arkansas has got to get another win at some point, and I think it's going to happen here.
All right. Then the game against South Carolina, they're going to host the Gamecocks. Arkansas leads this all-time series 14-10, but they haven't played since 2022. When the Razorbacks piled up 295 rushing yards and never trailed in the game, won 44-30. The Gamecocks get it done here, Justin?
Yeah, the Gamecocks cruise here.
All right, so 3-7, two games left on the road against Texas. Do I even have to ask you, Justin?
No, you don't.
All right, so we're looking at 3-8 right now. Then they host LSU to close out the season. Arkansas has lost 9 of the last 10 in this matchup and have lost 5 in a row at home versus LSU.
Yeah, the stadium's empty at this point, and they're about 10 games in the basketball season and rooting on their basketball team. So,
well, that is a 3-9 season. The Vegas over-under is 4.5 wins. The over is plus 136, and the under is juiced big time to minus 168. Is this a stay away, or are you going to stay away? Yeah,
the stay away is too much juice, not worth the squeeze.
All right, Rob, last thoughts on Arkansas' schedule.
I had them 3-9 as well, and my wins are North Alabama, Vanderbilt, and Tulsa. So there we go. It's brutal, dude. It's absolutely brutal. They have Georgia, they have Texas, and they have LSU. And for whatever reason, they went out and scheduled Utah. I don't know. I'm not sure what the thought process is. I know that you got to have another Power Four, but, dude, Northwestern's out there. Call them.
Yeah, Wake Forest is out there. Call them.
Yeah, that's right.
Golly. But so, guys, this is another great show. Justin, thank you for coming on tonight. We're going to come finish the season next weekend. We talk about this Gamecock schedule, and then it's on to predictions. It's on to Gamecock predictions for their season. We're going to be right here for you. Justin, tell the folks where they can find you again.
Sports Cat Values for the casual better. Go check us out, sportscatvalue.com, and looking forward to football season.
All right. Well, we all got to stop what we're doing right now and head over to SEC Sunday Night, because Rob has promised me a very exciting first 5 minutes. So, y'all, we appreciate it. Thank you for being here with us. When you give us your time, it's the most valuable thing you have. Can't thank you enough. But head over to SEC Sunday Night, because Rob has an exciting 5 minutes that I can't wait for. We'll see everybody next week. Bye, everyone.